In the Wind by Anna Girl, read by Cookie Mom 6067. 1. At first, Rodney doesn't think too much about the four of them, other than the obvious. There's no point in speculating about genetics or the precise mechanisms of their healing. Elizabeth had shown them the letter when they'd arrived, handwritten by General O'Neill and hand-delivered by Colonel Caldwell, that made the parameters of their agreement with the SGC clear. It was a short letter with a simple list. 1. No genetic testing or biological samples. Don't even ask. 2. They follow their own rules, with the exception of communicating classified information. 3. Don't try to stop them if they decide to leave. 4. They're bringing swords. Just go with it. 5. Seriously, no genetic tests. They threaten to blow up the city and kill SGC command staff if anyone tries it. Daniel thinks they're serious. The genetic testing stuff, he'd said to John and Elizabeth after they'd all read the letter. It sounds like there's a story there, and that it's a bad one, Elizabeth had finished. Right. They're not puzzles he needs to solve or fix, and they're not his personnel to supervise, so he takes them mostly as they are, new additions to the city, just like so many before them, new additions with swords and axes, and who don't stay down when they're killed, but still not necessarily the strangest people he's ever met. Sure, sometimes he wonders what it's like to watch the world change so much around you, what it means to see everything eventually die while you're still breathing. And yes, sometimes he's envious, more often than not, at how casually affectionate Joe and Nikki are, how obvious in their devotion they can afford to be. He wonders what it would be like if John could lean back in the mess hall, arm draped lightly over Rodney's shoulders, or if John could look at him with the quiet affection that's on Nikki's face each time he looks at Joe. But mostly he doesn't think about them. There's too much work to do. Booker tells himself that he can do 100 years, even when he knows that he can't. He tells himself that keeping track of the four of them, tracing their movements, checking in on the various safe houses, following the money they move around as necessary, is all part of atoning for what he's done. Just someone watching their backs, silent and steady, keeping them safe, watching for things that go wrong. Maybe it is mostly that. He may not be able to talk to them, but he still knows their ways and patterns, so it is about keeping others from seeing those patterns. But it's also about connection, the tiny piece he can still have. He doesn't think about how he'll never see Andy again, aside from his silent monitoring distance. At least he has something. 2. Joe is drained by the Wraith, and somehow it's worse than Rodney's ever seen before. It's then that Rodney realizes 2 things, and he mentally kicks himself for not making the connection sooner. First, immortals would be irresistible to the Wraith. They'd drain them again and again, a perpetual food source, a life of constant torture. And second, the Wraith have a long history of genetic experimentation on humans. They'd be perpetual food sources in lab rats, as the Wraith tried to crack their genetic codes and transform the humans of the Pegasus Galaxy into more efficient sources of food. He sees the way Nikki cradles Joe's head on the Wraith ship, sees the misery on Nikki's face as Joe dies, and he thinks, no. He gets the data they're there for and rigs the ship to explode. He lets John bitch about the waste, how they could have used the ship tactically, and then cuts him off. What did you want me to do, Shepard? They'd be like catnip to the Wraith. They'd just feed from them again and again. We can't let anything about them get out. Of course we had to blow up the ship. John doesn't question it later, when they're alone, because he obviously knows that Rodney was right. He just asks, it took longer for the Wraith to drain him, right? It seemed longer. Yeah. It did. At first, they're reasonably easy to track. Andy, and maybe Joe and Nikki, probably have safe houses and bolt holes that Booker doesn't know about, things that existed before him. that they haven't had the need to run to in the last 300 years. But mostly he knows where and how to look for them. Sure, they'll disappear for a week here and there, but then he picks up traces, hints of the kind of jobs they're likely to take or sightings of Niall, who isn't as practiced at blending into the background. He tracks them, the UK to Egypt. Then they show up in Syria before going to ground for a while. There's movement in Taiwan, then the Congo, then Bolivia, Argentina, Finland. Short jobs, long distances. It's been a while since they worked this intensely, jobs back to back, but Booker's body remembers it, the disconnect between places, the way everything would have to be reset between time zones and climates. Tucked away in his tiny Paris hovel, he misses it. 3. A few days after the Wraith ship, Rodney's focused on approximately 4 different things when he hears someone say, "Dr. McKay?" He doesn't bother looking up because he can add a 5th thing to think about without actually having to look at the person talking to him. "What? I'm busy. This better be worth interrupting me because I'm making some very delicate calculations here." A bag, sturdy brown paper, no label, slides into his line of view and, huh, it smells like coffee. He looks up. "Oh, where's the sword?" he blurts, without really thinking about it. And Nikki's mouth quirks. "I didn't think it necessary inside your lab, so I left it with Joe." Rodney's never seen them not together, so he asks, "You left Joe somewhere else?" And he's just doing a magnificent job at talking today. What can he say? Maybe it's just a little disconcerting when an immortal mercenary shows up in your lab. Nikki smiles briefly and tilts his head towards the door. "I left him in the corridor." "Right, right." Watching the entrances and exits armed to the teeth. No wonder Ronan likes these people. So, what did you want? And is that coffee? Because if it is, and you're giving it to me, I'm definitely taking it." "He might just take it anyway, because it's on his workbench and finders keepers, right?" "I am giving it to you. We're giving it to you. As thanks for the ship." "Oh. Well, you're welcome. All in a day's work. Sometimes you have to blow things up." Nikki's grinning at him now, and he says, "Yes, we heard that you think this way, but we still thank you." Rodney reaches out and pulls the bag of coffee towards him, just to make it clear he's definitely accepting this gift. He's not quite sure what to say. He settles on, "I'm glad he didn't stay dead. Joe, that is." Nikki nods and says, "We should kill them all." He won't get objections from anyone on Atlantis on that goal. A few days later, he gets another visit. This time Joe comes too, but leans against the wall by the door, watching and not talking. Nikki does the talking. Rodney listens to a story that ends in horror, a story of drowning for 500 years, of being trapped and alone, of slowly going mad and sharing that madness through Niall's dreams. It's all he can do not to vomit. "Andy," Nikki says, "wants to know if you can find her. We all do." "Jesus Christ. You want me to find an iron coffin that's been underwater for 500 years, and you have no idea where they dropped it?" "Yes. Do you think..." Nikki looks hesitant, hopeful, despairing. "It would be possible. With the Atlantis technology..." "For fuck's sake." He closes his eyes, clears everything from his mind, and thinks for a few minutes. "Possibly," he says finally. "I need to think about it. And..." He opens his eyes, looks at Nikki. "And I'm going to need to talk to others about this. John, Raddick, maybe Sam Carter at the SGC. Are you prepared for that?" Nikki glances at Joe, and then they both look at him and nod once. "Okay," Rodney says, and waves them away. "I'll keep you posted." "What the fuck?" John says when Rodney tells him the story. "Drowning. 500 years lost at the bottom of the ocean," Rodney repeats, just in case it didn't sink in the first time. He's feeling nauseated again. He closes his eyes, leans his head against the back of the couch. "This is one of the worst things I've ever thought about." And he's thought about a lot of horrific things. They all have. This is the Pegasus Galaxy. Horror is the norm. And Rodney has started to wonder if he'd mostly become numb to so much of it. In some ways, he's glad he hasn't, but right now, he almost wishes he had. John's hand settles on Rodney's thigh, squeezes, and he leans into Rodney. So, is what they're asking possible? Probably. No fucking way are a bunch of dead sadist priests going to get the last word on this shit. That is not happening. Fuck those assholes. Booker loses them after Corfu. He knows they go. He knows they stay for less than 2 days, and he's fairly certain that they were there for business, not relaxation, because as far as he knows, there are no safe houses on the island. He tracks them there, and then they disappear. After weeks of not being able to pick up even the smallest trace, he realizes he's going to have to go to the island himself, look around, ask questions. But when he does, there's almost nothing. Someone tells him about a meeting on an isolated terrace between a group of people, maybe with two Americans, in the time frame that makes sense. But it's not enough to be sure. They're just gone. 4. He clears his schedule for half a day, and he and Raddick start early in the morning. The life signs detector is the obvious answer. Uploading it to a satellite system will be tricky but doable, and it's not clear if and how they could modify it to detect only human life signs. If it can't be used to differentiate Wraith from human, how much good will it be sifting through waters teeming with life? We could match life signs with metallic readings, Raddick asks, then immediately answers his own question. No, there's too much metal in the oceans already. Yes, yes, this is obvious. Scratch it off the list. Next. Perhaps we could extrapolate ocean current patterns back to 500 years, but without a basic idea of where she was dropped, it's pointless, Rodney finishes. What if we could track the relative... No, Raddick says, that will not work either, but it's an interesting thought. They hash it out for a few hours, with short detours onto other questions that come up, and a brief break for an emergency on the East Pier. Rodney even makes Nikki's good coffee. They deserve it. Finally, Raddick says, You say that Niall dreams of her. Does she ever see anything around her? Formations? Specific kinds of ocean life? This is an interesting question, and Rodney relays it. An hour later, Joe hands over a small pile of drawings in Rodney's lab, disjointed images that don't tell them much, if anything. Raddick sighs and rubs at his temples. Do not immediately discard what I am about to say, Rodney. Oh, this is going to be ridiculous. Just say it. What if there is a way to track this dream connection that Niall has? How does this dreaming work? Could it be monitored somehow? Absolutely ridiculous. Right. What are we going to do? Ask Miss Jojo the psychic to track her down? No, Raddick. No, you're grasping at straws. They both are. And honestly, if Rodney thought there was even a chance of tracking through psychic dream connections, he'd try it. But it's nonsense, and Raddick knows it too. So, Raddick says, what else can we try? Rodney knows what else they can try, but it means asking them for something they probably won't be willing to give. He finds the four of them at breakfast the next day and asks, How much are you willing to trust me? They're intimidating, sleek, and deadly, even first thing in the morning, hunched over food and coffee, eyes still a little bleary. He's fairly certain they could kill him without looking up from their trays, probably with their trays. Because I have an idea, and it might pan out. It might not, but it involves getting a little close to point number one on your no-go list. They just look at him. The point about medical testing, he clarifies slowly. Although, he adds more quickly, just to be clear, I'm not asking for biological samples, just some readings, with the help of some of the ancient medical diagnostics. Joe, Nikki, and Niall stop looking at him and turn to Andy, and it's eerie that they do it in unison. Rodney is absolutely not going to comment on that. We'll get back to you, McKay, she says, her expression implacable. A week after he gets back from Corfu, Booker receives a postcard in the mail. Colorado Mountains. Andy's handwriting. Stop tracking us, Book. It says, we're in the wind. See you in 100. He has no idea what that means. Where could they possibly go? 5. So here's the thing, Rodney tells them when they corner him in his lab. And really, it's gone from 1 to 2 to all 4 of them coming down here. And that's just pushy and rude. We don't know what exactly makes you, he waves his hand, not stay dead. But what if there's something different enough about your biology that we could detect in terms of energy readings or something? Maybe there are genetic things there too, maybe not. I'm not a medical doctor. But even if there were, it wouldn't help us find someone trapped under the ocean. But energy readings? Maybe. He knows he's talking too fast. But what do they expect? They're not exactly smiling at him right now. And if there's something, then we could maybe tweak a life signs detector to find it. And please stop looking at me like you're going to kill me. You asked me to think about this. You told me the tragic and horrible story of your friend being trapped under the ocean, drowning again and again. And this is what I've come up with. Maybe. If we can find something by scanning you with the medical diagnostics. He takes a deep breath. Also, the 4 of you looming over me in my lab like this is rude. There's silence for a moment, and then Andy rubs her hand over her eyes, slides onto a stool, and her shoulders are shaking just a little bit. Rude, McKay. He crosses his arms, because it's perfectly obvious she's laughing at him. Yes, rude. Might I remind you, again, that you came to me. Me, the chief scientific advisor, who has at least 11 things that he could be doing right now, and that doesn't even include writing up a scientific paper about my most recent discoveries. She stops laughing, eventually. How many of us would you need to test? All of you, in case there are variations, more data, better conclusions. She turns to the others. Joe? Nikki? They both shrug, though Joe is frowning. Niall? Sure, I guess, she says after a minute. Andy turns back to him. You can test the 3 of them. Why not you? She shrugs. I won't be useful to you. I'm not immortal anymore. Wait. What? What the hell? Since when? Since before we left Earth. What? Why would she? And how has she kept this hidden? But before he can ask questions, she says, and there's something else. Tell your people that there's someone else we want to bring here. Behind her, Joe shifts and looks momentarily pissed, and Rodney wonders what the hell is going on here. You want me to find 2 people? No, she says, we can find him. You focus on Quinn. Booker loses track of time. This might be fine if it seemed to be passing faster than it truly was, but instead it slows down, measured by empty bottles and bouts of regret and self-pity, rather than by minutes, hours, days. He dreams of nothing, or of Quinn, dying again and again, the cold of the water around her, the hatred and anger burning inside. Maybe he dies again and again himself from alcohol poisoning. Maybe it just feels like he dies. One morning, he comes to, mouth like a desert full of desiccated corpses, and on the floor by his door is a small stack of mail. Mostly advertisements, but there's one postcard. Colorado Mountains again. Andy's handwriting. A date. Time. Set of coordinates. It takes him a shamefully long time to realize he needs to clear his head and figure out what day it is. 6. They agree to the diagnostics with stipulations. No one knows unless they need to know. No medical personnel. And whatever he and Raddick find gets used for the purposes of tracking Quinn and then destroyed. No records, no traces, completely gone. This is possible, Raddick assures them, and Rodney nods because this is an area where Raddick excels. Rodney has his own stipulation. He wants to scan Andy too, no matter her claims of lost immortality. Fine, she says, less than gracefully. Huh. Rodney says, looking at the results of the first scan. Huh? Niall asks. What exactly does that mean? Rodney motions Raddick over. It means, huh, Raddick? Oh, Raddick says, peering at the readings. Oh and huh are not reassuring when you're lying on a diagnostic machine made by ancient aliens, Niall says. Oh and huh mean that this is possibly very interesting. Please get off the diagnostic bed, Raddick says politely. We will take Joe next. Thank you. 15 minutes later, Raddick and Rodney look over the results of Joe's scan. Oh, says Rodney. Huh, adds Raddick. Raddick nods, pointing at the screen. So if we... Yes, obviously, Rodney replies. That should work. It's remarkably simple. The programming will be tricky to make it compatible with. Yes, yes, it's always tricky. And you like to complain about it, Raddick. It is not complaining if I am merely stating a fact. This will need to be precise. Yes, and we'll have to compress the data to send it to Sam in the next data burst. The compression won't be a problem, but will she be prepared to enact? Raddick, please, we're talking about Sam Carter. Of course she will. It might be better if one of us went on the Daedalus to supervise implementation. He pauses and gives Rodney one of his significant looks, and to ensure also the removal of the search parameters afterwards. Well, this is a good point. Rodney can't disagree. It never hurts to be too careful. You or me? Who can Atlanta spare is the real question. Someone clears their throat behind them. Rodney turns, startled, and meets four pairs of eyes and four sets of crossed arms. Oh, right, they're still here. We have a plan. We gathered that, McKay, Andy says. Niall is frowning at them. Can you explain the plan? Well, we can, if you really want details. Raddick? Rodney lets him do the talking while he starts thinking through the coding. Raddick is more patient with the technologically challenged. Raddick coughs briefly. So, as you of course know, every living thing emits thermal radiation. And this is quite interesting, as some animals are able to detect it and use it for all kinds of interesting things, from navigation to finding possible mating partners. Of course, these mechanisms do not apply to humans. Of course they don't, Niall says slowly. Obviously, as we absolutely know. Good, good. The ancient diagnostic machine shows us that the four of you do not quite emit the same wavelength as the rest of us. It is a small variation, but measurable. Andy also, although she is not the same as the three of you, very interesting. This we must think about later, as it may have some relevance to her current status. Although, of course, I am not a biologist, so what can I say for certain? I'm so glad we asked for details, Joe mutters. Because we know this now, it means we should be able to modify the life signs detector program to specifically search for the wavelength emitted by Joe, Nikki, and Niall. This will be quite efficient. We will upload the program to one of the SGC satellites, or perhaps to a reconnaissance drone, and there you have it. We will find your friend. There is still the matter of the programming, which will be somewhat of a challenge, no matter what Rodney suggests, but we have time before the Daedalus next arrives, so we will work on it. Raddick stops talking and takes a deep breath. If you wish more specific details, I am happy to provide them. Andy turns to Niall. What did you understand in that? Niall shrugs. I know what a satellite is, and also a drone. Great. We'll just leave you to it then. Perfect. That's wonderful. All this talking is distracting, and Rodney has a puzzle to solve, and he needs Raddick to help. Yes, you can leave now, he says, making shooing motions with his hands. We're busy. Go find something else to amuse yourselves. They leave, although someone, he's not sure who, pats him on the shoulder on the way out. So, Raddick pushes up his glasses, I think that we should start by... Of course, Raddick's suggestion ends up being wrong, but it's a good starting point, and eventually they realize there's no point in programming a satellite or a drone when they could just build the scanning parameters into the Daedalus. Saves time, Rodney says, because what the hell else would one of them do on the trip back to Earth? Easier to delete after, Raddick adds. In the end, Rodney is the one who goes back to Earth. It makes sense. There are other things he should talk about with Sam Carter anyway, and Andy doesn't quite trust Radek. Which is stupid, because Radek is completely incapable of carrying off any kind of deception, but that's the way it is. Andy and Niall go with him. He's half listened to the argument about it, Joe and Nikki saying it was too risky for Andy, and Andy saying it was her responsibility to go alone. The compromise had been Niall, otherwise it would have been all four of them, and no one had quite wanted that. Rodney pretends it has nothing to do with someone needing to stay on Atlantis to burn it to the ground if Rodney and the SGC betray them. The trip is long, uneventful, and it takes Rodney approximately 2.5 days to get the program up and running. After that, he writes 7 papers that won't see the light of day for at least 5 years, if he's lucky, tinkers with some of the ship's systems just for fun, and actually sleeps more than 4 hours at a time. As they approach Earth, he starts to wonder if he should just periodically book himself a Daedalus sabbatical getaway, in between crises and disasters, of course. He arrives at the coordinates a day early and scouts the site. It's a diner, cheap and greasy, on the outskirts of Colorado Springs. It's a dump, and Booker wonders what the hell he's doing here. There are no obvious ambushes set up and no cameras that he can find, but he spends the night sleeping on a roof with a good sight line to the diner just to be certain. 15 minutes before the meet time, Andy and Niall stroll up to the diner's door. Andy pauses before going in, looking at the building around her. Then she turns to Booker's roof, sun glinting off her sunglasses, and raises her hand. He can't help but smile. When he walks in the door, she's got coffee and toast waiting for him. "Book," she says. She looks tired, but she's half smiling. "Boss," he says, and slides into the seat next to Niall. "I'm going to get food poisoning if I eat here. Hi, Niall." "Hi. You look good." He looks like absolute shit, and he knows it. "Eat your toast, Booker," Andy says as she leans against the table, "and we'll tell you where we've been." He eats his toast and sees that there's something different about her. He just can't quite put his finger on it. Of course, he doesn't believe their story until he's hundreds of feet underground and standing in front of the thing they call the Stargate. And he doesn't quite believe it then, either. Instead of accusing them of fucking with him, he says, "So, no more banishment for 100 years. And Joe and Nikki are okay with that." Niall looks away and Andy shrugs. "Joe might kill you a few times." "Probably slowly," Niall adds. "He's still very pissed off." "He wouldn't expect anything less." "And you trust these people, even after Merrick, even though you know what they could do to you, us." Andy doesn't nod, but she doesn't shake her head either. "We have some safeguards in place. These are Niall's people. She knows how to read them. And the Pegasus Galaxy is a challenge. It's fucked up and the people are crazy," Niall says. "Booker, you should see them. They're so determined." Andy shakes her head, but he can see it on her face. She likes the people in this ancient floating city. Or if it's not like, something approximating it. That's what it is, he realizes. That's what's different about her. And she sees him figuring it out. "We can do some good there, Book. And McKay figured out a way to find Quinn." "Quinn. You know she's insane. Not quaintly insane. Not fighting aliens in another galaxy insane. She lives and dies in madness and anger again and again. Finding her will be the easiest part because he also lives with a little piece of that madness sowed by his dreams of her and nurtured by his own grief. This will not be some easy, joyous reunion." Andy looks away and Niall frowns. 7. Rodney isn't surprised by how easy it is to pinpoint Quinn's location. Of course he isn't. He and Radek are unstoppable geniuses, especially when they work together, although obviously not everyone has received the memo yet. "Of course it worked," he snaps at the new one, Booker. "Did you think I'd just hop over from one galaxy to another thinking that it might work? I don't have that kind of time. Do you even know..." He throws up his hands. "You know what? Forget it." Turning to Andy, he says, "This is interesting. See how close she is to the coastline? That plus the reality of centuries in a corrosive environment probably means she would have been able to break free soon. Within a couple of decades, maybe a lot less, depending on how thick the iron was to begin with. He takes a deep breath. So, Andy nods. The room is secured. Right. Because they're not expecting a happy, grateful friend. They're expecting an insane, vengeful creature. And Rodney thinks that's just another horrific part of this entire story. And we can gas the room if necessary. I know, he says when Andy glares at him. But that's the way it has to be. We can't have her putting everyone here at risk. We won't all wake up again. He looks around, takes another deep breath, and snaps his fingers at the technician. Come on, then. Do it. They'd set up space in the aft hangar bay for the transfer, a two-room box isolated from all ship's functions. The interior wall separating the two rooms is half window, thick, unbreakable, and through it he can see a bed and table both bolted to the floor and a sink and toilet. The doors are magnetic locks, nothing to grasp, break, or pick. Even with the bright embroidered cushions and loose robe Andy had placed on the bed, the room looks uncomfortably like a cell. But the SGC had been unwilling to compromise on this. He can't blame them, and he also resents them for it. Booker watches through the window as she materializes in the middle of the floor, soaked, water pooling around her body. He's never seen her in his dreams, just the coffin and the water. She looks dead, cold, unremarkable. And then she takes a deep breath, gasping, coughing up water, retching more and more of it out of her lungs. Jesus, Niall mutters. Andy steps into the room behind them. Niall, outside. The door locks behind them, and they are absolutely not leaving it unguarded. Even now, even with this, they all know better. Quinn stops coughing. She sits up. She takes in the room around her. Each breath is deep, slow, like she's not sure she'll get another one. Eventually, she gets her legs underneath her, uses the edge of the bed to pull herself up to standing. She looks shaky, and water drips from her hair, adding to the puddles she's already standing in. She's naked, shivering, staring at the floor. Andy steps forward closer to the window. She raises her hand to knock to get Quinn's attention, but before her knuckles connect, Quinn looks up, and then she's throwing herself at the window, fists pounding, blood already streaking the glass, mouth pulled back in a snarl. She starts to smack her head against the glass too, again and again, until she knocks herself out and slides to the floor. Well, Booker says, glancing at Andy's stricken face, I guess that went well. The next time she wakes up, he's in the room with her. He'd insisted, and Niall had held Andy down when she tried to protest it should be her. Don't be an idiot, boss, he'd said, just before he'd entered the room, certain of what awaited him. When Quinn wakes up, she kills him in under 3 minutes. In between bouts of dying and breathing, he speaks to her in the French of his youth, which Andy says she'll understand. You should eat something, he manages to get out once, gesturing at the food on the table before she breaks his neck. Another time, he's on his stomach, her weight keeping him down. As the cloth tightens around his throat, he grates, They look for you for decades. They killed people to try and find you. So many people. She walked with grief all these years. She strangles him with the belt of the robe. She's wedged into a corner of the room, still naked, and eating an apple the next time he sits up. Her bites are small, precise, but he's not sure she's even tasting it. He glances up, and it's Niall watching him through the window now, her face grim. He nods. Put on some clothes, he says. You look cold. She just stares at him, still eating. You're safe here, he tries for a reassuring tone. She holds the apple core in her hand, looking at it speculatively. And then she's on him, legs straddling his hips, hand prying open his jaw so she can stuff the apple core in his throat. He dies, choking. again. He wakes up on the bed. She must have put him there. She's standing over him, wrapped in the robe, a soft, light silk in a deep, rich green. "Andromache," she says, and clasps her hands behind her back, as if to reassure him that she won't be killing him anytime soon. He's not fooled. Rubbing his eyes, he thinks about water. She's here, outside. "Andromache," she says again, her tone hard. "She's not immortal anymore," he says, carefully, because she needs to understand how things have changed. She tilts her head slightly and hums. Then she reaches out, presses her hand against his mouth, and holds his nose closed with thin, strong fingers. It's almost gentle. He doesn't struggle. He loses track of the number of times she kills him. He thinks the soldiers are periodically gassing the room as well, because the food and water get replenished, and sometimes he wakes feeling momentarily confused, unclear. He assumes that's the gas, or maybe not. This time, she hands him a bottle of water and an apple, and he moves to lean back against the wall. Her robe is tied closed, and her hair is pulled back away from her face. "Thank you."
"Booker, I saw your first death. You were very cold."
Her French is old, accented. He nods, drinking the water.
"What is this place?"
He struggles with how to explain it. Her knowledge of the world is centuries out of date, except, perhaps, through glimpses of his and Niall's lives and deaths. "It's a ship." Her expression turns fearful.
"No," he clarifies. "A ship in the stars, in the heavens. The world now is very different from what you knew."
She's quiet for some moments.
"Andromache, she will die?"
"Yes."
"Yusuf and Niccolo?"
"Not yet. They're fine. We're going to them." Perhaps her expression is satisfaction. It's difficult to tell.
"And the girl?"
She nods in the direction of the window where Niall is watching them again. "Who is she?"
"Niall. She's new."
"There are others on this ship of yours?"
"Yes."
Again, he's not sure how much to tell her. "They're soldiers. We go to a place where there's a war." She sits down on the bed. "To fight." He shrugs.
"Andy and Niall fight. Nikki and Joe, too. I will join. But your path is your own. You will be safe, free, regardless."
Though he questions the wisdom of bringing Quinn to a city surrounded by water. She hums lightly and chews on a piece of bread.
"I am very angry," she says finally. "Andromache is scared of me."
"Of course not. She wanted to be the one in here with you. Niall had to hold her down. She will not forgive that easily, but it was the right thing for us to do. You could not be trusted."
"My mind is not right."
"Obviously."
"I apologize for killing you," she sighs. "I will likely continue to do so for some time."
Before he can answer, Niall is knocking on the window. He nods at her and she presses the intercom on the wall next to her.
"Booker," she says, and Quinn startles at the sound. "Is she done killing you yet?"
"Probably not," he answers, and then translates the question to Quinn, though he suspects she could understand well enough. She smiles at him, showing all of her teeth. "Well, tell her if she wants to talk to Andy, she better get her shit together, and tell her to save some killing for the Wraith." He relays both messages, tries to explain about the Wraith, even though he has an incomplete picture of them himself. In response, she narrows her eyes.
"I would like to speak with Andromache, please."
The conversation is in a language Booker doesn't understand, and he suspects is older than Nikki and Joe. It's sharp, Quinn's tone alternating between soft and angry, the words sometimes slow, sometimes much faster. Andy stands at the window, arms crossed. Quinn paces in the small room, throws whatever she can get her hands on. At the end, they're both quiet for a long time, watching each other. Booker looks away from the wordless intimacy. He looks back when he hears a sharp crack
and sees that the food tray is in two pieces in Quinn's hand. She crosses the room to him and stabs the sharp edge into his throat. She's stroking his hair when he breathes again. "That was unnecessary," she says. "My apologies. I believe I will need to work on my control for some time." He laughs, short and sharp. Dried blood pulls at the skin of his neck, itching. "I give you my word that I will not attempt to kill Andromache." He nods, although he doesn't believe her, but it's a start. "Or any of the humans on this ship. Or in the city where we go." "Of course. But I understand that I can kill these wraith, correct? With impunity? That this will be welcomed?" "Yes." "How much longer until we arrive?" He has no idea. He looks up, sees Andy watching them. She presses the intercom and says, "We're 2 days out." He closes his eyes and wonders if he can get some sleep before they arrive. 8.
"It worked?" Radek asks as soon as Rodney is beamed back to Atlantis in the center of the gate room.
He takes a deep breath of air, looks around him at familiar faces. John is standing just behind Radek, smiling slightly. Elizabeth is watching him from the control room, and he waves absently at her. "It worked," he confirms, nodding at Radek and grinning at John. "She is completely batshit insane, and there's another one now, too, Booker. He's an ass, and she killed him approximately 100 times on the way home."
"Jesus, Rodney," John says. "How much of a security risk are we taking?"
"Well, not in terms of the technology anyway, because she couldn't even figure out how to open a water bottle at first. And there's no indication she has the gene. She's promised not to kill Andy or any of us. I'm not sure what that means for Joe, Nikki, Niall, or Booker. You should probably set up quarters for all of them in one of the uninhabited towers for a while to be safe." He pauses, grins. "Got any very risky missions coming up? Because I think she could use an outlet. Or maybe you could just drop her on a hive ship and stand back." John swears and walks off, already radioing Lorne. Rodney is so glad he doesn't have to worry about security escorts or containment procedures. Although he'll definitely hear all about it later tonight, he's going to have to think up an appropriate distraction. Radek is grinning at him, bouncing on his toes slightly.
"So it was a success, and you removed the programming from the Daedalus."
"Definitely a success, even more effective at finding her than we'd expected. We made it look easy. And yes, all traces are gone. Nice work on that, by the way." They walk out of the room, because Rodney doesn't need to be around when the rest of them arrive, and he doesn't need to see the tense reunions that are bound to follow. But he does need to make sure the labs haven't descended into incompetent chaos while he was gone. "Any crises I should know about?"
Radek snorts. "Well, perhaps you will be very interested to know that 3 weeks ago, Kusanagi found a hidden room in one of the labs, and when we opened it..."
Rodney walks, settles into the familiar sounds of Radek's cadence as he tells the story, and mentally starts a list of his next priorities, now that he doesn't have to be thinking about ancient immortal rescue missions. It's good to be home. Booker is in awe of the city. It's like nothing he'd imagined, even with the stories Andy and Niall had told him. Nikki, they said, has some kind of ancient gene that means he can interact with it in ways the rest of them can't. He wonders what that feels like. But ultimately, it doesn't matter. Even without that capacity, the city is a wonder.
"Hi," Niall says, as she comes to stand beside him on the balcony.
They're quiet for a moment, looking out over the city and the ocean in the background. He hasn't spoken with Joe and Nikki yet, just nodded at them from a distance as they converged around Quinn and Andy. He doesn't mind. He can wait. He deserves to wait.
"Amazing, right?"
She nudges him with her shoulder. "So, she killed you. A lot. You want to talk about it or anything?" He grunts. "I mean, it was pretty gruesome to watch. Andy and I had to take turns. It was kind of awful." It was something he could do for them. A burden he could take on. He doesn't need to talk about this. The deaths had been easy in the scheme of things. She'll probably do it again, he warns. Maybe you too, if you get in her way. Joe and Nikki, most definitely. There's a lot of anger there. They'll need to keep her away from people for a while too, but they all know this already. Niall turns to face him, leaning against the railing, and when he looks over, she's grinning at him. She can try. Some of us don't roll over so easily. He can't help his laugh. You've been spending too much time with Andy. Her grin widens. Maybe. And a few others here, too. She reaches out and pats his arm, warm and real. I'm glad you're okay. And I think you're going to like it here. It'll be good for you. Looking away from her, back out at the city's towers, he doesn't know if she's right, but he's willing to give it a chance. End.